My name is Kishore Chandiramani, and I welcome you all to the first in a series of 6 sessions on stress management. This program is an integrative model that includes a number of different therapy approaches, including some borrowed from Eastern traditions. The main therapy approaches included here are: number 1, psychoeducation, that is, acquiring information that the clients can use for themselves with little help from professionals. Number 2, introduction to different types of relaxation methods and how they work. Number 3, elements of cognitive behavioral therapy and psychodynamic therapies. Number 4, existential psychotherapy, that is, a therapy based on philosophy. Number 5, biofeedback therapy, that is, using electronic devices and computers for stress management. And finally, I have discussed some theoretical aspects of Vipassana meditation that are related to stress management. Vipassana is an intensive form of mindfulness meditation which can be learnt only in residential courses, and this program is not a substitute to the actual practice of Vipassana. In this first session, I'll be discussing what causes stress and the principle of impermanence which can be used to manage the stress. Now, looking at what causes stress, the first and foremost cause is the judgment that we make. Judgments about different situations in terms of good, bad, right, wrong, beautiful, ugly, intelligent, stupid, nice, nasty, about ourselves and about others. There's nothing wrong about making those judgments. If those judgments are based on a realistic appraisal of the situation, they're not disproportionate and don't last longer than needed. But unfortunately, these judgments are made automatically or instantly without collecting adequate information. And also, they are generally made when we look at the reality through the tinted glasses of our emotions. According to an estimate, about 8 out of 10 thoughts that come to our mind don't represent the reality out there accurately and need to be fine-tuned. And this fine-tuning involves disengaging with the immediate judgment, which allows the mind to attain a state of neutrality, which is then followed by appropriate judgments that happen naturally. Now, the next question is, how do we fine-tune our automatic thoughts? And the answer to that is, we don't need to fine-tune our thoughts if we are able to free our minds, or at least a part of it, from strong emotions. We'll be discussing a number of different ways by which we can free our minds from strong emotions and as a result be able to make appropriate judgments. A discussion on judgments and how they influence our stress levels is a topic for third session, but I'll briefly talk about it here. As a habit, we tend to be judgmental more than is required in everyday situations. So the effort needs to be on becoming less judgmental. And it may be that people who are more judgmental and rigid about their views are more stress prone. And those who can be less judgmental are less stress prone. The next cause of stress is our inability to accept change. we want the same things that satisfy us to continue indefinitely, or we get easily bored by the sameness and want change, which is not happening. The reality is that change is constantly happening all the time, every minute, every day, every year. And if we think that things are not changing, it's an illusion of the mind. I've come across people who say, I've been in the same marriage for 50 years, or I've lived in the same house for 30 years. But if one looks carefully, it's not the same house, it's not the same marriage. The curtains are different from what they were 30 years ago. The sofa might be different. It may be that some extensions have been built. Children who lived in the house have moved out, and they are no longer children. The whole environment of the house, the neighborhood, the local shops are not the same as they used to be. In the same manner, the marriage is not the same. The relationship progresses from being intensely romantic in the early years to a more mature and stable connectedness, which may have more of intimacy and friendship and less of romance. The change is happening all the time, constantly, irrespective of whether we like it or not. And I ask clients to visualize their lives not in terms of something solid, but in terms of something fluid that's constantly shifting, constantly moving. Things are disappearing. Things are constantly changing outside of ourselves and within ourselves. Sometimes when we suffer from anxiety and depression, we want to feel the same as we felt a few years ago. But that's not possible. Life moves on. Even those who don't suffer from anxiety or depression can't be the same as they were a few years ago. Life moves on. And those of us who can accept change are much the stronger for it. The slogan that may be appropriate here is, expect the unexpected. The next thing that causes stress, and it's related to the one we have just discussed, is separation and loss, or a fear of it. Separation and loss are inevitable. A reminder of our own mortality, that eventually we will die, our loved ones will die, is constantly nagging us from the unconscious mind, even if we don't want to think about it. You might be familiar with the proverb, don't scratch where it doesn't itch. So why think about death if by thinking about it, we can't undo it and end up feeling miserable? The fact of the matter is that thoughts of death are itching us all the time. A fear of death manifests in many disguises, such as fear of heights, flights, traveling, driving on motorways, crowded places, close places. And most panic attacks are about fear of death or losing control over oneself. Acceptance of death and getting ourselves desensitized to it can be a remedy for a lot of clinical anxiety that we see on a daily basis. Most religions, including Christianity, encourage us to think of our own and others' mortality in prayers. It may sound unwise or cruel on the surface, but if one thinks deeply, our thoughts of mortality make us a better human being. We become more forgiving of others, less angry with them, more generous, more generous, and more kind. and also less critical of ourselves and others. It brings a sense of detachment from worldly strife and induces inner acceptance of life. I admit that those who are frightened of death and the slightest reminder of their mortality brings out enormous anxiety in them might need to undergo some form of therapy before they can use this coping mechanism. So to start with, one can say to oneself, the situation that I am in right now is temporary. The thoughts entering my mind are temporary. The feelings in my heart are temporary. And to remind oneself of this all the time, I ask them to use little colored dots or stickers all around in their surroundings, on their bathroom mirror, on the computer desk, on the television set, on their bedside table, car dashboard, kitchen table, fridge, and so on. Whenever they see the colored dot, they have to say to themselves, the situation I am in is temporary. The thought running through my mind is temporary. The emotions in my heart are temporary. This can be applied to therapy settings as well. Coming for treatment is temporary. Being under medication is temporary. My symptoms are temporary. Seeing the doctor is temporary. And so on. If you are having a panic attack, then saying, the panic attack is temporary. The feeling that I can't cope with things is temporary. I see no hope for myself. This thought is temporary. I feel incapable of doing things. This is temporary. I have low self-esteem. This is temporary. I'm getting agitated. This is temporary. If I'm experiencing hallucinations or having strange experiences, that is temporary. If I can't forgive certain people, this is temporary. If I can't give up my addictions, this is temporary. If I can't bear the situation that I'm in, it is temporary, and so on. Once in a while, clients come and ask me, is it not a negative way of thinking that you are seeing everything as temporary? Even good things are temporary. They are going to go away one day. And my response to that is, no. Just because you have said something is temporary, it will not disappear. It will go only when its time comes. Saying this to yourself will stop you from creating new emotions so you can handle the existing ones better. Applying this to good things can make you realize that today that thing is there with you, so you can enjoy their presence much more. Life appears much more beautiful in contrast when we have thought about death. Things give us more pleasure when we think of their existence coming to an end eventually. When we see the unpleasant as temporary, a part of our mind stops reacting to it in a negative way. This results in freeing up of some energy, and that energy can help us deal with the situation better. A situation that is intolerable becomes tolerable. A further cause of stress is our inability to understand the true nature of human life, by which I mean the true nature of our own being and that of the external world. We tend to have a romanticized view of human life and sometimes fail to make a distinction between what is normal suffering and what is abnormal. By normal suffering, I mean the suffering of a person who doesn't suffer from any diagnosable psychiatric problem. Usually, some people have the feeling that they are the ones stuck here, and everybody else seems to be getting on fine with their lives. It's because they haven't examined others' lives under a microscope. And if they do, they'll find that there is an element of universality in human pain. The suffering of an average or normal person is also enormous. Those of us who can't come to terms with it are more likely to develop psychiatric problems. The next thing that can give rise to stress is wanting to be in control of our lives all the time. We want to be in full control of our lives, our situations, our surroundings, our thoughts, our loved ones, our feelings, and anything unwanted that happens to us gives rise to stress. Or if the good things that we hope for don't materialize, that gives rise to stress. Unfortunately, things don't happen that way. I encourage clients to visualize their minds in terms of the internet. There's a lot of information out there, wanted and unwanted, helpful and dangerous, good and bad. We can't control the contents of the internet, but we can negotiate our way in such a way that we focus only on the relevant and helpful information. When you Google a word on the internet, you find a drop-down menu which tells you everything that has an association with that keyword. In the same way, when a thought arises in the mind automatically, dozens of situations, thoughts, places, emotions, people are activated in the mind, and they may not be related to the actual thing that we are looking for. People who are over-controlling start getting worried about why a particular thought entered their mind. And the answer to that question is, because this is how the mind functions, and you may not be responsible for it. Just because a thought has entered in my mind doesn't mean it belongs to my true self. No matter how unpleasant, how horrible a thought is, coming of that thought to one's mind was not abnormal. What can be abnormal is how one responds to it, how one understands it, and what one's intentions are towards that thought. I normally ask people to do a little exercise when they get up in the morning to write down all the things that they propose to do. And at the end of the day, before they go to bed, to look at the things that they actually did. And to their surprise, they find that they were not aware of about 60 to 70% of the details of things that happened on that day. They had not even thought of the situations they would be in, what things they would be required to do, who they will meet, what decisions they will make. Which means that 60 to 70% of things are happening in reality which we had not foreseen. Wanting to be in control and doing things our way will make us unhappy 60 to 70% of the time. In that respect, letting go of the desire to control each and every bit of our lives can be a very liberating experience. And being open to what comes our way, intended and unintended, can be helpful. In this respect, I ask clients to visualize their thoughts and feelings in terms of a river flowing, and you are the person sitting on the banks of the river, watching the flow. One might see all good and bad things happening. Sometimes people partying on the boat, singing and dancing. At other times, bunch of flowers, or maybe dead cattle, or sewage water flowing down the stream. The person sitting on the banks of the river has no control over the stream of the river. She can't stop the flow. And whatever comes in front of her has to pass, good or bad. In the same way, whatever comes into our minds, no matter how horrible the thought is, no matter how unpleasant the feeling is, it can't stay there forever. It has to pass. Choosing to act on certain thoughts and feelings is different from questioning the existence of them and eliminating them. The other example is that of a tree. One can visualize oneself in terms of a tree and all their thoughts and feelings as birds perching on the tree. They look the part, but they don't belong to the tree and eventually will fly off. In Vipassana meditation, the mind is likened to a guest house and the individual as the owner of the guest house. All the thoughts and feelings that come to the mind are like the guests who check into the guest house. When a nice person comes to stay in the guest house, the owner of the guest house doesn't become overjoyous, because she knows that eventually he'll be gone in a few days. And if a bad person comes to stay in the guest house, the owner doesn't become depressed, because she knows that eventually that person will be gone too. So the solution to the problem of wanting to be in full control of oneself is surrender or letting go. It is important to note here that we are not surrendering the action, but our preoccupation with the results of our actions. Some clients find it helpful to know that there is a higher intelligence at work. And by this, I'm not referring specifically to God. The natural processes supporting everyday actions are highly complex, orderly, and precise. And we can't claim credit for that. For example, for my body to function properly, there are dozens or maybe hundreds of chemicals which are secreted in very minute quantities, nano picograms of insulin, adrenaline, serotonin, and any little deviation from the precise quantity can give rise to illnesses. Now, I don't even know the names of those chemicals, leave aside having the ability to produce them and control their release. So there is some sort of higher intelligence at work supporting my life. And applying it to psychology would be like saying to oneself, when one's plans don't seem to be working, that there is some sort of an intelligence working and some sort of control somewhere influencing my life. Having trust in that higher intelligence or the laws of the universe can be a liberating experience. We set time scale to our plans and judgments, but sometimes we don't realize that nature has its own time scale for us. And the nature's time scale has the veto power over all our plans. This does not mean we surrender our appropriate actions and become fatalists. The next cause of stress is selfishness of people who are close to us. If we examine it closely, it is our own selfishness that can make us prone to hurt in the face of others' selfishness. A completely selfless person is more immune to the hurt resulting from others' selfishness. By saying this, I'm only giving you an additional viewpoint to look at things. I'm not suggesting that one should put up with others' selfishness all the time and become self-sacrificing to a fault. From an existential point of view, we are all alone. We were born alone and we'll go from this world alone. And our loved ones will not be there with us to answer for us when we are facing our ultimate destiny. Every relationship, no matter how close it is, has its own boundaries. And beyond those boundaries, we are all alone. We are all following our own life trajectories, which are different from those of other people. And from that perspective, being selfish would be quite normal, as long as there is no exploitation involved. If you are stopping somebody from exploiting you, you are not being cruel to them, but helping them live the right way. The next cause of stress is relationships. And both the extremes of being in a relationship can give rise to stress. On one hand, there is loneliness, where we get the feeling that the other person doesn't care about us enough, and we are left to our own devices. There's no togetherness. And at the other extreme, there is enmeshment, that is, too much involvement to the point of controlling each other and having a lot of expectations from the other person, which can be stifling. It's a paradoxical situation that we live on a planet inhabited by billions of people, and every place we go to is crowded with people. Shopping malls, hospitals, schools, colleges, train stations, coach stations, but still people feel lonely. This loneliness can disappear for short periods when we are with people. But when that comes to an end, we are left with the same old feeling of loneliness. It's important to make a distinction between loneliness and aloneness. There are people who are always surrounded by others, but still feel lonely inside. And there are those who live alone, but still don't feel lonely. The topic of loneliness is covered in detail in later sessions. But for now, I'd like to say that one can visualize loneliness not as a situation or a state that one is in, but as an emotion, like any other emotion, such as anxiety, depression, anger, and it comes and goes. It should be seen as a temporary phase. Even when one is alone all day, loneliness hits them only for a few minutes at a time and goes away and comes back. So loneliness is not a necessary accompaniment of being alone. When one becomes skillful in managing aloneness, they start enjoying being on their own, and at the same time, they enjoy togetherness as well. Running away from loneliness can make it worse for us, but being in the midst of it and not reacting to it can help us penetrate through it and reach inner peace. The next thing that can give rise to stress is a fear of not being able to do the right thing or doing the wrong thing and not knowing what is the right thing to do. In this respect, I'd like to say that the part of the mind that is equanimous or emotionally neutral is likely to perceive the reality more accurately. And the actions that are carried out from the equanimous or balanced mind are more likely to be appropriate. And in this respect, attempting to keep at least a part of our minds equanimous or neutral can be helpful. My suggestion would be to keep at least a part of your mind free from entanglements of worldly affairs or the politics of everyday life. Whether you are in a relationship or not, whether you are rich or poor, whether you have a job or not, whether you are in good health or not, a part of your mind should stay above all those concerns, and the decisions taken by that part of the mind are going to be appropriate, because that part of the mind will be fully aware of all your concerns and at the same time will not be emotionally bound and will have some free energy to take appropriate actions. The next cause of stress is how we evaluate our lives. Whether we see ourselves as successful or a failure. And the answer to that question is both. We are successful and we are failures in our lives. We should refrain from making any global judgments of success or failure, but go deep and try to analyze and make a list of ways in which we have been successful and ways in which we have been failures. Letting go of unrealistic life goals can protect us from a lot of experience of failures in life. So in this session, we have talked about different causes of stress and how the principle of impermanence can help us deal with them. In the next session, we'll talk about a model of the mind that can help us understand the common psychological symptoms and how they are produced. Thank you very much.